Stand up straight, Catherine murmurs, like a princess of England. Braced against the chair back, Mary takes a deep breath. She turns to him her plain, pinched face, hard as Norfolk's thumbnail. It is early afternoon, very hot. The sun casts against the wall shifting squares of lilac and gold. The shrivelled fields of Windsor are laid out below them. The Thames shrinks from its banks. The Queen speaks in English.
Do you know who this is? This is Master Cromwell, who now writes all the laws.
That's Christopher Oxford reading Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, winner of the 2009 Man Booker Prize. And Hilary Mantel joins me on the line. How are you today?
I'm fine, Rob. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, first of all, tell us about Wolf Hall.
Wolf Hall is a novel I've been thinking about for a long time, maybe 20-odd years. I've been thinking one of these days I'll get round to Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's minister, is the hero. He's at the centre of court affairs in the very busy decade of the 1530s, when he's Henry's right-hand man. But I take you back to his early life. Thomas Cromwell's background for a courtier was very unusual. He was born in Putney around about 1485. His father, Walter, was a brewer and a blacksmith. He was a violent man. He was a heavy drinker. Around about 15 years old, Thomas Cromwell ran away from home, crossed the Channel, joined the French army, then began on a series of adventures, about which we know startlingly little, except that they took him all over Europe. He came back to England in his late 20s, speaking many languages, and apparently knowing a bit about, well, most of the things you might want to know about. Finance, the cloth trade, commercial law, went into the service of Cardinal Wolsey, and from there transferred into the King's service, and made the most amazing career, rising from his beginnings in the blacksmith's yard to be Earl of Essex.
It seems quite a mighty rise and rise, and he's been described as Alistair Campbell with an axe. Do you think that's a fair description?
I think Thomas Cromwell probably had a little bit more subtlety, at least than in our popular picture of Alistair Campbell. I would say the axe was hidden behind his back. But certainly he was a very powerful man. He was a very ruthless man. He wouldn't have been any use to a king like Henry VIII if he'd been any other way. He was also tremendously clever, quite charming, a good conversationalist, good company, well-read and interested in everything. Quite an appealing character in many ways, although in popular English history and in the novel, he's often painted as a kind of pantomime villain.
What I noticed from the novel is you may not like the decisions he's making, but you can see why he's making them.
Yes, the point is about this novel, you're standing in his shoes. So you are following him at every step of the twisty-turny political path. And you always have to say, in this situation, what would I do? Would I do any better?
Now, do you think our image of Cromwell has been tainted by the Robert Bolt play A Man for All Seasons?
Definitely. It's been influential as a play and as a film for two generations. It's very good drama, and that's why. As history, of course, it's hugely biased in favour of Thomas More. There's nothing particularly wrong with that, because a novelist or a dramatist really doesn't have to be impartial in the way that a historian has to, but I do think they have to be informed and they have to work on the basis of the facts. They must treat the facts honourably. Now, Bolt's version is highly partisan, But then so is my book, and I thought it's time we had another look at Thomas Cromwell. And my book isn't consciously an attempt to rehabilitate him. I doubt if he should need that. But it's an attempt to walk forward, as I say, imagining that you were in his shoes and seeing the world from his point of view. And from that point of view, Thomas More looks very different from the hero of Robert Bolt's play, who has, after all, not worn too well, because Robert Bolt's Thomas More is really a 1960s liberal, an idea which would have made the real Thomas More turn in his grave.
Now, how would you describe yourself, then, as a historian or a novelist?
Oh, very much as a novelist. But I probably take the historical side of my work more seriously than many historical novelists, because for me it's the facts that spring imaginary constructs, that spring metaphor. It's objects, documents, the source material, everything grows out of them, and artifacts like portraits and so on. So I have to have all the basic work in place, and I'll be pretty dogged in pursuing a fact that appears to be missing. But then, of course, we do come up against the gaps, to the great frustration of historians and biographers, as well as novelists. And it's just that I think there comes a point where the biographer, say, has to draw back and say, beyond this, it's mere speculation. But everybody knows that that's part of the novelist's trade. So you can push ahead into those dark areas and try to find out something of that life that we know must be there, but which hasn't come down to us. Cromwell, his public career is very well documented, but his private life, to a large extent, is hidden. And yet, we know that it existed. Like everyone else, there was a personal side to his life. Like everyone else, he was seething with memories and dreams and maybe regrets and hopes for the future. So what the novelist can do on the basis of the fact, speculate about what these hopes and fears and dreams may have been, and try and reconstruct a character from the inside.
Now, how long did it take to research this book?
Well, I have been thinking about it, as I explained, for quite a long time. But when I finally decided I was going to do it, and the time had come, I would say about 5 years in the research and writing.
Madam, shall we go on in English or Latin? Your cardinal would ask the same question, as if I were a stranger here. I will say to you, as I said to him, that I was first addressed as Princess of Wales when I was 3 years old. I was 16 when I came here to marry my Lord Arthur. I was a virgin, and 17 when he died. I was 24 years old when I became Queen of England, and I will say, for the avoidance of doubt, that I am at present aged 46, and still Queen, and by now, I believe, a sort of Englishwoman.
So where does the title Wolf Hall come from?
Wolf Hall is the name of the Seymour's house in Wiltshire. It's still there, although nowadays there's a Victorian farmhouse on the site. But Wolf Hall, I liked it, you know, for its metaphorical resonance. In a sense, everywhere that Henry goes is Wolf Hall. He's surrounded by his predatory pack of snapping courtiers. But also Wolf Hall as a real house is the destination point of all the characters. At the very end of the book, Henry is off on his summer holidays, summer progress. He's going to travel across the West Country. And one of the places he's going to visit when he's on his way back to London, he's got 4 or 5 days, early September, and he's going to go to Wolf Hall. And that's how the book ends, with Cromwell writing the itinerary and writing in these words, Wolf Hall. And I like the idea of a book that was always in progress, right till its final two words.
In the convivial days between Christmas and New Year, while the court is feasting and Charles Brandon is in the fens shouting at a door, he is rereading Marsilio of Padua. In the year 1324, Marsilio put to us 42 propositions. When the Feast of the Epiphany is passed, he ambles along to put a few of them to Henry. Some of these propositions the king knows, some are strange to him, some are congenial in his present situation, some have been denounced to him as heresy. It's a morning of brilliant, bone-chilling cold, the wind off the river like a knife in the face. We are breezing in to push our luck.
So what do you think our fascination with the Tudors is?
Well, they certainly have a kind of soap opera element written into them. You see, this story, King has six wives, kills two of them, divorces two of them. You couldn't make it up. You absolutely couldn't. People would accuse you of being melodramatic. And yet, these are the facts of English history. So, I think we're brought very close to these people on a human level. Even though the Tudors were very different from us, there is something in common in the psychological setup here. Henry was a very modern man in many ways. He was a great romantic. And in an age of arranged marriages, Henry wanted to be in love with his wives. So when he wanted to get rid of his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, the fact that he'd long ago fallen out of love with her was part of it, I think. And his plan, because he didn't have a son to succeed him, his fellow monarchs sympathised. Even the Pope could have been brought to sympathise. Annulments like that were granted all the time. So Henry's path should have been easy. But he went and fell in love with a totally unsuitable woman. Not the French princess everyone expected him to marry, but Anne Boleyn, the daughter of a mere gentleman, with something of a past, something of a question mark, certainly, hanging over her sexual history. So falling in love was what really complicated Henry's life. Then he fell out of love and developed a great passion for Jane Seymour, who was going to be wife number three. And in the course of time, a marriage was arranged to Anne of Cleves, whom he couldn't love at all. Of course, the men of his generation didn't understand his hesitation. Why didn't he just hop into bed with the girl and do the business? But Henry wasn't like that. His psychology wasn't set up that way. We've all known, I think, women who are something like Henry's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, in that they're a career wife and they'll hang on to a dead marriage. And we've all known someone like Anne Boleyn, who's the mistress on the make. So even though there's a yawning gap of 500 years, we can still look at the world about us and we can find comparisons. What we have to remember, of course, is that Henry didn't know he was going to have six wives. Even when he was up to wife number five, he didn't know it. So we have to get rid of any idea that these things were preordained and see these people as human beings moving through history with no foresight, only a lot of muddle and misinformation around them. And I think this period of history, because it's so personal, it makes it very human. And also there's another thing about Henry's reign which is interesting, in that women have been bit players in the English monarchy until now. But suddenly a woman and her body and what her body can do is centre stage. It's the absolutely vital factor, because what Henry needs and wants more than anything is a son and the woman who will give him a son, and the whole politics of the reign begin to centre around this question of a woman's body.
Now, you mentioned Jane Seymour. You don't portray her as the milksop that she's portrayed as sometimes.
We don't know an awful lot about Jane, historically. But what we do know suggests that when the king cast his eye on her, she played her hand very, very coolly indeed. If she'd been intent on reeling him in, and if she'd been planning it for years, she couldn't have done better. So she understood Henry, and I think she understood the power play of the court and how to use it to her advantage. So Jane, simply because we don't know much about her, is often assumed to have been a kind of non-person, a sort of dumb blonde. But the fact is, everything we do know about her suggests that here's a woman with a good wit and a good brain in her head, and the cool courage to exercise it.
Since the year began, they have brought certain bills into Parliament. Until now, Master Cromwell's talent was for money-lending, but now he finds he has a talent for legislation, too. If you want a new law, just ask him. I hear that at night you'll take the drafts to your house in... Where is your house? She makes it sound like your dog-hole. Mary says,
these laws are written against the church. I wonder that our lords allow it.
Now, this is your 10th novel. Have you ever written a blind character?
Yes, I have. In my novel, The Giant O'Brien, there is a blind man, a musician. We're in Ireland at the end of the 18th century, when, of course, many blind people were musicians and poets and occupied an important place in society. Now, Therese, my blind man, is in the novel. It's quite a small part. But when I wrote a radio version of The Giant O'Brien, then Therese became the narrator. He became the guide to lead us through. And it was Therese who, not able to see, and never in the position of the radio listener, it was Therese who opened up the world of 18th century England and Ireland for us.
RNIB have a campaign at the moment asking people what would they miss the most if they lost their sight. What do you think, personally, you would lose the most?
Well, I'm someone who reads as I breathe. You know, I'm constantly reading. I know I shouldn't do it, but I walk about the house in my reading glasses because at any moment a piece of print may swim up. I would have to learn to read in a completely different way. I think what I would fear almost as much is my ability to read people by looking at them. And I do appreciate that one can relearn. But I think that my heart goes out to anyone in that situation, because I know that it would appear to me in the first instance to be a catastrophe, and one would have to do a great deal of learning and be very brave in that situation. I'm losing my hearing as it happens, and I know that this hearing loss will continue over the years and that it will be something I will have to negotiate, but I know that I will manage. I know I will learn that somehow. It wouldn't impinge on my life in the way the loss of my sight would.
Henry goes off to get into his double-padded riding coat. He thinks, we don't want our king to be the poor man of Europe. Spain and Portugal have treasure flowing in every year from the Americas. Where is our treasure? Look around you. His guess is the clergy own a third of England. One day soon, Henry will ask him how the crown can own it instead.
Back to Wolf Hall. Thomas More's still alive. The King and Thomas Cromwell are about to embark on a journey to Wolf Hall. It sort of ends looking for a sequel. Is there going to be one?
There is going to be a sequel. I'm working on it now, or at least I will be when I stop jaunting around the country and doing the post-booker publicity. It's called The Mirror and the Light, and it's going to take Thomas Cromwell to the heights of power through the next 5 years. He's going to see the destruction of Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour become queen, give Henry his longed-for heir, Jane's death, and the disastrous marriage with Anne of Cleves, and Henry's fifth wife, Catherine Howard, on the horizon. There's civil war. There are all sorts of upheavals in the Cromwell household. I can manage, I can promise that it will just be even more charged with events, if that's possible, than the first book. And I can't wait to be at it, because in some ways I feel as if when I finished Wolf Hall, I left them there with their suitcases packed, ready to hit the road. And I really want to be back there with them.
But it's not going to take you another 5 years to write it, is it?
No, it isn't.
That's okay.
I, in the ideal world, I would have it out for 2011. Of course, this is not the ideal world. And I've inevitably lost a great deal of time recently. So it will take whatever it takes, but I think not more than a couple of years.
Well, whenever it comes out, we're looking forward to it. Hilary Mantel, thank you very much for joining me on today's Talking Books.
Thank you, Rob.